Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this Courthouse Steps oral argument on two cases, Oklahoma versus Environmental Protection Agency and EPA versus Calumet Shreveport Refining LLC, in which we'll be discussing the venue selection for judicial review of the EPA's Clean Air Act final actions. Speaking with us today, we are joined by James Condi, who is a partner at Boyd & Gray. And moderating the discussion, we have Garrett Crowell, who's an associate at DLA Piper's in Washington, D.C. office, where he practices administrative and environmental law. During the first Trump administration, Garrett worked at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency as a special advisor. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speaker, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions, so if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speaker and not the Federalist Society. And with that, Garrett, thanks so much for joining us today. I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you, Edie, for the introduction, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting today's event. Before I introduce our panelists for today's Courthouse Steps discussion, I want to make a couple of points up front. And first, as Edie said, if you would like to ask a question during today's discussion, please use the Q&A chat function at the bottom of your screen there. We're going to go ahead and endeavor to answer all of these audience questions as time allows. Second, this discussion is being recorded, and you'll be able to find it, as well as a library of similarly valuable material on the Society's website and Apple Podcasts store for free download. So I commend that to our audience. And before I introduce our panelists, I want to give a shout out to the audience. Thank you all for attending. And thank you, Jimmy, for offering your expertise on these important Clean Air Act cases. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce Jimmy, as I said, and then he's going to open it up with his thoughts and impressions on these cases, and we'll turn to audience questions. So Jimmy Conde is a partner at the law firm Boyd & Gray. There, he specializes in energy, environmental, and administrative law, with a particular expertise in the Clean Air Act. Jimmy began his legal career as a judicial law clerk on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third and the D.C. Circuits. All right, Jimmy, I'm going to pass it over to you now.
Thanks, Crowell, for that introduction. So the cases argued last Tuesday, and there were two of them, turn on a very unusual venue provision in paragraph B of Section 307 of the Clean Air Act, which is codified at 42 U.S.C. Section 7607. Now, I'm going to just use the numbers, the statutory numbers of the Clean Air Act, because using the code numbers requires me to use four numbers, which is a little too many for my head, but I'll go ahead and, you know, try to give you the code numbers whenever I switch to a different provision as well. So Section 307 of the Clean Air Act, which was amended in 1977, challenges to EPA action to the courts of appeals. But that's not what makes the provision unusual. Rather, what makes it unusual is that Congress appears to have given EPA some discretion to make the D.C. Circuit an exclusive venue in some category of cases that otherwise would belong in regional circuits, such as the Fifth Circuit or the Sixth Circuit. Now, these cases arise from basically the Biden administration's use of that discretion, which used the discretion somewhat aggressively to try to channel as many EPA actions as possible away from the Fifth Circuit and to the D.C. Circuit, which tends to be fairly deferential to EPA. So the question before the court on Tuesday really was just how much discretion does EPA have to route cases to the D.C. Circuit? The answer turns on the meaning of an exception in a very convoluted statutory text. Now, as good Federal Society textualists, we're going to start there with the text. So the text of the Clean Air Act's venue provision recognizes two types of challenges against EPA action, with the term action being the key word. Actions listed in the first sentence of the venue provision are national and belong in the DC circuit, while actions listed in the second sentence generally, and I stress generally, are regional and belong in the regional circuits. Now, as I will discuss later, there's an exception to the second sentence that is crucial to the litigation here. Let me start first with the two sentences. Now, the first kind of challenges to national actions are spelled out in that first sentence. The sentence is a bit of a mouthful, so I'm not going to go through the whole text, but essentially it spells out several actions that EPA can take that apply nationwide. For example, standards of performance for new stationary sources under Section 111 of the Clean Air Act, or controls for new motor vehicles under Section 202 of the Clean Air Act, and then ends with the following capital phrase, again, as amended in 77, which says, and I quote, or any other nationally applicable regulations promulgated or final action taken by the administrator under this act may be filed only in the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. In other words, nationally applicable final action has to be filed, challenged in the DC Circuit. The second kind of challenges, and I'll call them challenges to regional actions, are spelled out in the second sentence. So again, the statute lists several specific types of regional actions, including, as relevant here, the approval of a state implementation plan, and then has a similar catch-all phrase at the end that says, and I quote, or any other final action of the administrator under this act, including any denial or disapproval by the administrator under Title I of this act, which is locally or regionally applicable, may be filed only in the United States Court of Appeals for the appropriate circuit. Now, as crucial to the two cases here, however, the second sentence has an exception that really was the focus of Tuesday's cases. And so the exception, which is really the most important provision at issue in both cases, says, and I quote, notwithstanding the preceding sentence, essentially the sentence that sends cases to regional circuits, a petition for review of any action referred to in such sentence, including presumably approvals or denials of state implementation plans, may be filed only in the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia if such action is based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect, and if in taking such action, the administrator finds and publishes that such action is based on such a determination. As I said, it's quite a mouthful. So to summarize, the statute directs nationally applicable final actions to the DC Circuit and locally or regional applicable actions to the appropriate regional circuit, except when the action is based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect, and EPA so finds and publishes. Now, this being a Federalist Society call, I started with the text, but now I do have to bring up a little tidbit of legislative history that did play a role during arguments on Tuesday. So, in essence, it seems fairly clear from the legislative history that this exception was added at the request of EPA's general counsel, William Frick. So I'm going to try to call the exception the Frick exception from now on. So essentially, when the amendment was being proposed in 77, Frick said, and I quote, that although approvals and promulgations of state implementation plans under the Clean Air Act usually involve issues peculiar to the affected states, such actions sometimes involve generic determinations of nationwide scope or effect. So he gave two examples of past cases he claimed should have been litigated in the DC Circuit. The one example, the probably most important one, was an extension of attainment dates of the National Ambient Air Quality Standards for numerous states based upon the unavailability of a necessary control technology, a case that was litigated in 1973. He said, because essentially those extensions were all premised on EPA's conclusion that a particular technology needed to comply was not available, that that national issue should have been litigated in the DC Circuit. The second example is a rulemaking, which would still go to the DC Circuit anyways under the first provision, nationally applicable regulations. So that may not be that relevant to the litigation. Now, I think it's important here to mention that when Frick talked about the need for this exception, he explained that these actions involve uniform principles for all states, a single administrative record, and third, and I think this is the most important thing he mentioned, these issues do not involve factual questions unique to particular geographic areas. So that brings us to the two cases argued on Tuesday. And now let me start saying the background for both cases. So the first case, which is the more difficult of the two, at least it seemed from the justices' questioning, involves exemptions for small refineries under the Renewable Fuel Standard, which is a program added in 2007 to the Clean Air Act and is in Section 211O or 42 U.S.C. 75450 of the Clean Air. So under that program, essentially, petroleum refiners have to blend a specific quantity of renewable fuel set by statute or buy credits from those who do. Some refineries, however, can seek exemptions if they can show that they would suffer disproportionate economic hardship. Now, in the case before the Supreme Court, EPA essentially published 36 denials of refinery exemptions in one Federal Register notice, and then 69 other denials in another Federal Register notice. In denying those exemptions, EPA relied on essentially three steps. First, EPA said that the statute meant that the economic hardship had to be due to the renewable fuel standard itself, not other factors. Second, EPA claimed that based on the economics of refining and the RFS program generally, small refiners can pass through their costs to consumers, meaning they do not actually suffer any economic harm from the program. Therefore, EPA established what it called a rebuttable presumption that refiners can pass through their costs. Third, and I think this is crucial, EPA allowed each refinery to come in and rebut the presumption with specific evidence about each particular refinery, including the refinery's local market conditions and other factors that may make the refinery not able to pass through their costs. Now, although historically EPA had taken the position that challenges to small refinery exemptions are local and thus litigated in the regional circuits, in this case, EPA claimed that the denials were both nationally applicable final action and also based on a determination of nationwide scope or effect under the Frick exception. And so the DC Circuit was the exclusive venue. Petitioners didn't really listen to EPA and they sued in the regional circuits. And as relevant here, the Fifth Circuit rejected EPA's motion to transfer several challenges to the DC Circuit and ended up vacating the refinery exceptions. EPA then sought certiorari and the court granted review. Let me first talk about how argument went in that first case, as this case essentially consumed most of the court's time. So the case, which was argued by Malcolm Stewart of EPA, of the Solicitor General's office, made two alternative arguments to support transfer to the DC Circuit. First, to claim that the actions were nationally applicable, the SG's office essentially argued that by bundling several exemption denials together in a single Federal Register notice, EPA could just make the denials nationally applicable. Now, I have to say that argument did not impress any of the justices. It seemed clear from the skeptical questioning and the justices' raised eyebrows that this argument will be rejected by all nine justices. Everyone, it seems, from Justice Thomas to Sotomayor and Jackson made clear that this argument was a non-starter. And there are, I think, two reasons for that. So first, the argument clearly conflates the actions that EPA takes here, the denial of an exemption, with the formality of how EPA chooses to publish the actions in the Federal Register. Just because EPA takes a bunch of separate actions and bundles them together in a single publication doesn't make them one action. Second, the argument would essentially allow EPA unlimited discretion to route regional action cases to the DC Circuit, regardless of whether the actions are based upon a determination of nationwide scope or effect, thus essentially swallowing the FRIC exemption. So the stronger alternative argument raised by the SG was based on the text of the what I've called the FRIC exception, and most of the oral argument was devoted to exploring the meaning of that exception. According to the SG, the term based on in the exception requires a but-for causation analysis. And the court and the SG relied for that on the court's opinion in Bostock. Further, the term determination refers to the reasons EPA gives to support a conclusion, as opposed to an ultimate conclusion. Although the SG did concede that maybe determination was limited to the core reasons and not peripheral reasons given by the agency. To put that together, according to EPA, anytime any one of the core reasons EPA uses to reject an otherwise regional action is applied consistently nationwide to more than one entity, the FRIC exception allows EPA to route cases to the DC Circuit. As became clear during argument, as soon as Justice Gorsuch started questioning EPA's argument, one big problem with EPA's interpretation is that to avoid acting arbitrarily, EPA has to apply uniform reasoning to address regional actions anyway, because it would be arbitrary and capricious to treat similarly situated entities differently. So the FRIC exception, as read by EPA, would essentially always be satisfied, because there are always common reasons to deny or to act on an application. Otherwise, you know, EPA would be violating the law. So to avoid that problem, the Solicitor General argued that EPA could only trigger the exception when the reasons relied upon by EPA were, quote, unsettled and thus likely to be contested. And he suggested that you could figure out that by looking at the comments filed by the parties. As became clear fairly soon, the problem with the SG's reading is that it's very complicated. As the Chief Justice mentioned a couple of times during argument, venue provisions have to be clear. Every hour wasted by an attorney or a court trying to figure out the proper venue is a complete social waste. And I'm sorry to mention this, and I'm a lawyer myself, so I'm a member of the guild, but attorney's fees are very, very high. So I think the chief was very concerned with making sure that whatever interpretation court comes up with allows litigants and courts to determine venue fairly easily. But the problem is that the Solicitor General's reading of the venue provision is very difficult to determine and raises very difficult questions. So one question is, how core is a core reason? What if the reason satisfies, you know, supplies maybe 2% of the determination, ultimate conclusion, or maybe it affects 50%? How does one even know? How central is central? And then the other question that the Solicitor General's argument raises is how settled is settled, particularly in Loper Bright? How many times does an issue have to be litigated for it to be considered settled and therefore no longer eligible to be routed to the DC Circuit? Now, from the first, you know, from the first argument, it seemed fairly clear that Justices Gorsuch, Alito, Thomas, and likely the chief did not want to go down the Solicitor General's path for that reason. It just raises too many difficult questions. By contrast, the justices seem more interested in adopting something like the Solicitor General's argument, where the two justices to the very right of the court, and I don't mean right ideologically, I mean the justices who sit all the way to the right, and those are Ketanji Brown Jackson and Justice Kavanaugh, unsurprisingly, recently, who the justices who most recently worked at the DC Circuit. So that, whereas, you know, Justice Kagan has called them the DC Circuit cartel. So they seem to be the more supportive of EPA's argument, with Justice Kavanaugh suggesting that complications arising from all the questions that the justices were worried about could be taken care of by simply applying arbitrary and capricious review to EPA's venue determinations. In other words, deferring to EPA's conclusion as to the proper venue. Justice Kagan also seemed supportive of the SG and tried to simplify the issues, saying that courts should just look at what is, and I quote, basically determining EPA's decision. Now, that's pretty abstract, but essentially what Justice Kagan was saying, that although EPA sort of, you know, allowed people to come in and rebut the evidence, that the presumption that refiners could pass through the costs, EPA didn't really mean it. Essentially, the presumption was really fatal in fact. And so the court should really find the venues in the DC Circuit, because the only thing that mattered was that presumption, which EPA applied to all intakes. Now, in my view, that approach would seem to reward EPA for being disingenuous. It would also still raise line drawing problems. How would one know if a particular reason given by EPA, and I quote, is basically determining the outcome, unquote, and whether EPA is really just kidding about the opportunity to rebut the presumption. Now, the small refineries were represented by Perkins Coie, and at least some listeners might be relieved that they were in fact allowed into the building without issue, and they offered a very simple and clear test. So a determination, in their view, is an ultimate conclusion found in the statutory text. Here, the conclusion that a refinery suffers no economic hardship. Because the text is clear that that is a refinery by refinery determination. The determination was not one of nationwide scope or effect. As became clear, however, the problem with this argument is that it would give the exception, the Frick exception, very little effect. Indeed, when pressed by Justice Kavanaugh, the small refineries have a very hard time thinking of examples of otherwise local actions that could satisfy the Frick exception. Now, to summarize my impressions from the argument, it seemed that by the end of it, Justice Kagan was ready to rule for EPA, and she indicated quite clearly during the argument that she was going to split the baby, that her intuition was that one case should come out one way and the other case should come out the other way. And it seemed, based on argument, that this, she thought that this first case essentially should be transferred to the DC Circuit. And I will say that at least my impression was that Justices Kavanaugh, Jackson, and Sotomayor would be ready to join her in so holding. Now, my impression was also that Justices Alito, Gorsuch, Thomas, and the Chief seemed skeptical of going down that road. And so I think the case, at least the first case, will likely turn on Justice Barrett. I think that's probably a good sign for the small refineries, because, at least in my view, Justice Barrett seemed to be leaning against EPA's reading in this case. Now, I think personally that would be the best rule, going with the small refineries here, because as Justice Gorsuch suggested, if EPA really wants to channel litigation to the DC Circuit, there's a clear way for it to do so. It can use general rulemaking and promulgate a rule that doesn't include any local issues, and that avoids any difficult questions of venue. And the regulation would be nationally applicable and would go to the DC Circuit. So there's no reason for EPA to complicate sort of what would be traditional regional actions by trying to do essentially rules through adjudication, when it could so easily do so through normal rulemaking. And that would avoid any difficult questions of venue. Now, to turn to the second case, Oklahoma versus EPA. That case involves a challenge by Utah and Oklahoma and private industry to an EPA action essentially rejecting the state's implementation plans on account specifically of their failure to meet their good neighbor obligations under the Clean Air Act with respect to ozone. Now, this is a very similar case, except that, you know, whatever national aspects were at issue in the prior case involving small refinery exemptions are even more diluted in this case. So, as EPA said when analyzing whether states had met their good neighbor obligations, it would generally use common modeling and a common framework, including a screening threshold to measure states' contribution of air pollution in downwind states, but that its framework wasn't mandatory and that states could depart from it based on, among other things, local conditions and could also develop their own model. Here, Utah and Oklahoma essentially did that. They tried to develop their own modeling. They tried to suggest that different screening thresholds should apply to them, and also did a lot of sort of local analysis of their own particular sort of regional air quality conditions. And the 10th Circuit said that nevertheless, the rule was nationally applicable, essentially buying EPA's bundling argument that the Supreme Court clearly was not buying on Tuesday. So in my view, this case is easier than the other case. Everybody agrees that the framework that EPA was applying was non-binding and that the cases involve many, many local issues that likely and have prototypically been fought out in the regional circuits. The one thing that was interesting about the second argument, and I'll say that by the time this second argument was happening, I think most of the court was already pretty tired. Argument had been going on for about 2 hours. So there was a lot less questioning of the advocates. But maybe the most interesting exchange happened when the attorney for industry, Misha Seitlin, got up and started talking about why he doesn't want to be in the D.C. Circuit. And he did say that, you know, he does think that the judges in the D.C. Circuit are highly qualified and excellent attorneys. But the problem with getting consolidated in the D.C. Circuit is that you get put into this complex docket, and then they'll assign very limited briefing space for your particular local issues. And you'll be, you know, forced to write in 2 pages what in a regional circuit you would get maybe 20 pages to develop. And that essentially that causes the D.C. Circuit to maybe perhaps overlook some significant issues because they can't be adequately developed by the parties. Now that triggered Justice Kavanaugh to say in response that no, that doesn't happen, that, you know, the D.C. Circuit does pay attention to all the issues raised by the parties, and that is not a problem, indicating again that Justice Kavanaugh was apparently willing to side with EPA on this one and hold that the first case, if not the second, should be transferred to the D.C. Circuit. Now, I think the chief seemed to sort of get the concern raised by Misha, and he said, well, really, like, how well can you litigate these local issues if you can only file one brief for, you know, 23 states, all raising different local issues? And usually the D.C. Circuit is pretty stringent, and I think Justice Roberts knows this from personal experience, pretty stringent with respect to briefing words. So I think that was sort of telling of many of the reasons why the advocates are fighting hard about venue in this case. And it'll be interesting to see how it turns out, but I think it's fair to say that I'll give the edge to the advocates arguing for regional circuits and not sort of transfer to the D.C. Circuit. And I think with that, I'll close my remarks.
Well, thank you, Jimmy, for that overview and for your impressions on these cases, which are complicated because they involve the Clean Air Act, and which are also complicated because They involve a particularly tricky statutory provision on venue, as you mentioned. To the audience, if you've got questions, you can go ahead and enter them into the Q&A chat function. Right now, I don't see any audience questions. So if you were so bold as to enter a question, you could be first in the queue. I'll go ahead and hop the queue right now, take the moderator's privilege, and ask the first question. So I also picked up on a couple of things that you noted in Justice Kagan's remarks that these cases could come out differently. The RFS could go to the DC Circuit and the SIFT denials could go back to the 10th Circuit. What would that look like? Would that look like, you mentioned maybe Justice Barrett writing one opinion and maybe the Chief Justice writing another opinion? Do you have any additional thoughts on that? Care to expand on that at all?
Well, I think Justice Kagan is going to work hard and try to split the baby and have, I don't know who will get the writing assignments, but I think she's going to try hard to get Justice Barrett's vote for the first case. And maybe that means Justice Barrett, if she does agree to go along with Justice Kagan and Kavanaugh and Jackson and Justice Sotomayor, will end up writing the opinion. On the other hand, probably the most lively justice on the other side was Justice Gorsuch. So he might get the assignment if the chief sort of ends up, you know, if Justice Barrett ends up joining that coalition of justices, it ends up thinking that the cases should stay in the regional circuits, then I think it's possible that the chief would assign it to Gorsuch. I mean, that's all speculation, but I think it's very, very possible that they'll split the baby and send the RFS case back to the DC Circuit. But again, I think I lean towards thinking that that case is going to, you know, that they're going to uphold the Fifth Circuit's decision not to transfer the case to the DC Circuit. I think it's going to be close.
And for our listeners, you know, when should we expect a ruling in these cases?
Well, yeah. It's a late March argument. And particularly given that they seem to be almost evenly divided and that there will likely be a dissent, I think it's going to take them some time to work it out, and I wouldn't expect anything until June.
All right. How about just taking a step back and looking at the bigger picture, what might this mean for the new administration? You know, it's the beginning of the Trump administration, 2.0. We're going to be taking a lot of actions. Presumably, some of them are going to be under the Clean Air Act. Will this have any implications for the administration?
So the administration probably doesn't have much of an interest in routing cases to the DC Circuit. So my impression, I mean, they, as you've seen from recent litigation, they have not been having great success over there. So my impression or thought on that would be that they would just not invoke the exception that was at issue in these cases, right? At least if they don't want cases to go to the DC Circuit, which I think would be likely. And so this issue wouldn't really have great significance during the Trump administration. I do think it's going to have significance for other actions finalized at the tail end of the Biden administration. So just to give you an example, on March 6th, EPA approved a waiver for it's called Advanced Clean Cars 2, essentially the California 100% electric vehicle mandate. And although that waiver technically is only applicable to California under another provision of the Clean Air Act, every other state can then adopt identical standards. And so, you know, a few folks have sued in the DC Circuit to challenge that decision. A few other folks have sued in the Ninth Circuit. And so depending on how this venue case plays out, you know, there'll be a fight presumably over where those cases should be litigated, and it might help resolve those cases. And again, if there's a different, you know, administration in the next, you know, in four years from now, it's also going to have quite an effect on their ability to send cases away from, you know, regional circuits and take them all to the DC circuit. So, So to summarize, I don't think it's going to have much of an impact on the Trump administration's regulations or deregulations, because all the deregulation has to go to the DC circuit anyway, and all their regional actions, they can just choose not to invoke the exception and have those litigated in the regions.
Okay, we got a question here from the audience, and it says, if I recall, the small refiners are dealing with hardship petitions from a couple of years ago, from 2018, and they didn't get a decision for those exemption petitions until 2022. So will the slow pace of adjudication play any role in the court's thinking here? You see any difference in lag times there? Is that going to affect the court's thinking? Might it?
So just the delay in granting the or denying the exemptions, is that the question?
That's right.
So this was part of the argument. So part of the argument that the refiners made was that the reason they chose to apply this new methodology in adjudications was because if they did it through rulemaking, it would be retroactive. And you can't do that. So essentially that the way they framed it is that EPA was trying to get around limits on retroactivity by doing it through adjudication, and that the court should take that into account, sort of shouldn't reward EPA with its choice of venue when it's essentially trying to evade limits on retroactivity by essentially doing rulemaking through adjudication. So it might play a role. Essentially, it was part of the briefing. You know, EPA on the other side would say, well, we were delaying the exemptions because there was litigation ongoing about some of our exemptions. There was a Supreme Court case in the middle. And also, we were trying to decide all of them together so we could apply a common framework. So, you know, EPA has its responses to that, and the refineries have their views, but I don't think it's going to play much of a role, but it definitely was part of the arguments on Tuesday.
We got another audience question here. It says, it's talking about the Clean Air Act, just the statute itself. Any efforts you know about or have seen to trade press or elsewise that Congress might take a look at the venue provision? Could something come after the court's decision? Congress could maybe rewrite this section of the act?
Well, they should. I think they should delete the exception because, as I mentioned, EPA can always use its general rulemaking authority if it wants to resolve nationally applicable issues by setting up a common framework. And so there's really no good reason for this exception, and Congress should not have listened to EPA's self-interested general counsel back in 77. But alas, it's there in the text, and we have to live with it. And you know, I don't see any prospect of Congress amending the statute. You know, you need a filibuster-proof majority to do that, so it seems unlikely. You know, unless there's a massive change in, you know, in the Senate in the next few years, that there's going to be any movement to amend that provision. So I think we're stuck with it for now. And so the question is really, is the court sort of going to make it have almost no effect, or is the court going to allow EPA sort of broad discretion to choose whether to invoke the exception and route cases to the DC circuit? So we'll see.
We will see. An excellent summary. Thank you again, Jimmy, for taking on two cases and, you know, in one webinar and the difficult topic for the Federalist Society. So Thank you, Jimmy, and thank you to the audience for tuning in. Thank you again to the Federalist Society. Edie, can I pass this back over to you?
Yeah, just to echo that on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to James for speaking with us today and Garrett for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thanks once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.